Welcome to the Lean Health Tech Podcast, where industry professionals discuss trends and topics where efficiency, healthcare, and technology meet. My name is Taryn Shipley, and I'm your host. Our guest speaker today is Dr. Ruben Amarasingham, founder and CEO of Pieces. Tell me a little bit about your background. What are your areas of expertise, and how did those align to create Pieces?
Well, first of all, Taryn, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak on your show. My background comes from a couple of different perspectives. First, you know, and foremost, probably is being a physician. I'm a fifth generation physician, and you know, have a lot of reverence for the field and for the not only the practice of medicine and the innovation in medicine, but also kind of the history of medicine, how it's developed. And so that's been obviously a big part of my background. And then I've had a longstanding interest in computer science and data analytics from a young age. And I also got postgraduate training in biomedical informatics, where my focus was on predictive modeling in healthcare and how do you build kind of electronic-based models or electronic data-based models. And so that's been, you know, a big part of my kind of orientation. And then last, I've a lifelong interest in English literature and studied in college and was always been interested in kind of both the spoken and written word and how it's best communicated. And I think medicine is, you know, largely a field of information and communication. And so that, you know, all three of those areas have kind of played into my current work.
Word on the street has it that you love soap notes. Tell us a little bit about why you love them.
That's great. I think that the soap note, which was developed by Dr. Thurlow Weed in the 1960s, he published a really seminal paper in the New England Journal of Medicine talking about the title of the article was Medical Records That Guide and Teach. And his thesis was that if you write as an industry, as a profession, start creating a daily progress note on a patient, the act of writing the note, the act of developing the note with certain structural components is going to actually lead you to the answer as to what's happening with the patient and even perhaps help you with the treatment plan. And that construct became what's known as the SOAP note, which is divided into four sections: subjective, objective, assessment, and plan. And to me, the construction of that SOAP note, which we can get into detail if you'd like, Taryn, that those four areas are like a perfect distillation of what the patient is experiencing right now, what objectively the symptoms and signs that they have, and then a summary of what's happened to them up to this point and what we think is going on, and then the plan section. And when it's done really well, when a SOAP note is written really well, to me, it's a perfect set of writing. To me, it should be held up as not only like a medical guide or document, but also like just a perfect form of English literature. And in really in any language that you do the SOAP note, it's just a perfect set of communication. And so I think it's incredible innovation that Dr. Weed came up with. And then it immediately took off in American medicine. One of the first fastest adoption rates, some people would say, is not a technology adoption. So I'm really kind of a student of SOAP notes. And when I was in medical school, I would actually, medical school and in post, I would, when I came across a really good SOAP note, I would really kind of linger on it and spend time looking at it and how they wrote it. And so it become like a connoisseur of soap notes over time.
A lot of times people think documentation is a necessary evil, and maybe it's only benefiting the future physician so they can look back and see the patient's state, you know, in a historical or previous time. But it sounds like what you're saying is the soap note really is productive for the physician writing the note.
100%. Unfortunately, the modern day progress note and SOAP note has changed drastically from its origin, because over time billing came in and we started having to put a lot of information and it was information added to the SOAP note around justifications for payment. There was other kind of administrative and quality-based functions, all very well-intentioned, but it distorted, I think, the original purpose of the SOAP note, which was to be a relatively concise document that clearly led the physician to, a better understanding of what's happening to the patient, and as you said, would help instruct the following physicians as to what's going on. And so the question is, how do we get back to that original purpose while also satisfying all these other demands? So because of what's happened with the needs for these other forces in the note, I think it's documentation has become something that people don't like to do. And one of my like major objectives or goals is to really restore documentation to its proper place, to make it obviously easy and even fun to do, but most importantly, to really make it a tool to help improve patients and obviously the doctor's thought process. So that's like a really critical thing that I think we need to get back to.
Yeah, and that's a great segue actually to tell us more about PIECES and what problems in healthcare does PIECES solve?
Yeah, so I think probably what we're most well known for at this point is summarization of what's happening to a patient. So that's probably one big area. I'll come back to that. The second area is all the things that flow from summarization, because if you can properly summarize a patient, no matter how complicated, no matter what their age group is, no matter what their specialty is, to summarize, you have to have an understanding of the patient. And from that understanding, you can also do other things like write a full progress note, write a full discharge summary, or draft those things. The piece of software will actually do those things on behalf of doctors and nurses and case managers. The second thing that we've had a big focus on is the idea of predictive modeling. So, can you anticipate what's going to happen to a patient before it happens? This is now widespread in the industry and it's been done well. I think that predictive models is actually one of the hardest areas to do well. And unfortunately, many people on the front lines are understandably tired about predictive models. They don't feel like it helps them. It's like, you tell me a risk about a patient, tell me something I don't know already. What do I do with that? And so we're very focused on how do you make predictive models more effective and useful. The last thing is that beyond the predictive models, we also have a focus on helping with various kinds of initiatives that are related to these things. So, for example, trying to improve length of stay for patients using a combination of the documentation work as well as predictive models, trying to improve number of patients that need to properly, that might be at risk for cardiopulmonary arrest and multi-system organ dysfunction, making sure they're transferred to the ICU in time. Obviously, big focus on progression of chronic disease as well as readmission to the hospital. So all those are kind of areas that flow from combination of, predictive models and better and improved documentation.
There's a lot to unpack there. Let's start talking about the summarization function just because you mentioned it first, and then we'll dive deeper into the predictive models piece. For the summarization function, I would imagine you're using an existing large language model. Are you guys using ChatGPT or Claude?
So we have kind of agnostic approach. We have an approach that uses both our own capabilities as well as large language models that are available to the market. So the first thing that PIECES does is we have a natural language processing engine. It's a combination of both NLP and predictive modeling that we've developed that brings the data in, Taryn, and slices it into a time series understanding of the patient. So let's say that the patient was in the hospital for 7 days. This sort of comprehension engine tries to understand what's happening to the patient at each moment. What are the various conditions? Who are the doctors? What are the treatments? And creates sort of a chronological understanding of the patient that uses both our own natural language processing engine and predictive models. And then we use a combination of we're kind of based on an AWS foundation system where we have a number of different models available to us, including Claude 2 and now Claude 3, We also use GPT-4. We're experimenting with Llama models, and essentially, when you have these different types of models, we have a what's known as a large language model conductor that kind of determines which large language model is the right one for a given task, for a given cognitive task. And so we use different ones for different components, and we kind of optimize based on performance and cost. And then after we kind of create the kind of initial summary, so we have that initial chronological understanding, it sets up the information that needs to go into a large language model. Then we have a number of different models that go in sequence. They could be a combination of all those models. And then afterwards, we use adversarial AI to kind of check the output of the large language model component and looking for kind of errors in the summary. So the sole job of this adversarial system is to say what might be happening. And then if there's something that appears to be an error, or there appears to be a kind of hallucination, it's sent to a team of board certified physicians that are on our staff 24/7 that review the output, and it can't proceed to the health system customer unless it's been reviewed. So that's kind of the pipeline of how our summaries are created.
That is brilliant. No one large language model is perfect. So you guys are kind of taking the best of all of them and doing a double, triple check to minimize hallucinations.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You kind of really framed it correctly that I think what we're observing with all the large language models is there's more and more developing, as you can see, that the well-known ones are getting better, and we're having newcomers come on, and the costs are dropping. And so really, we've tried to set up a system where we can just replace the large language models instantly. And we also have fail-safe systems where if one system went down, then we can switch to another. We haven't really needed to do that. But if that were to occur, we're able to do it similar like to cloud systems where you need to do that. So I think being able to be not dependent on any given model, and then we are noticing that these different models almost have, I wouldn't say personalities, but different capabilities and different strengths and weaknesses that can be applied in different situations. And so we like track that very closely and use that to apply to kind of different clinical scenarios.
I love the design of the backend. It was very thoroughly thought through with the fail safes, using the best model for the specific task, the double check. Let's talk about the end users on the front. Is it difficult for end users to learn this, or is it pretty intuitive?
By end users, you mean like the doctors and nurses on the hospital front lines? Yeah.
Does it take weeks and weeks of training and setup, or is it pretty much you flip the switch and they can intuitively figure out where to click on the screen?
Pretty intuitive, and you can they figure it out in about 5 minutes. So we primarily work with Epic Electronic Health Record, which is an unbelievable EHR. I mean, I've had many years of practice with Epic. We've developed with them an integration with Pieces where it just is native inside of Epic, and so essentially you go to the Epic dialog box on the patient list screen. And you can, there's just a drop down, you search for Pieces, and you can pull in the Pieces summary and all other kind of documentation right into your patient list, into PAF columns in the patient list. So, most of the users on the front lines, from doctors, nurses, and others, they're intimately familiar with that. And so it's just kind of a routine, training, where it takes about 3 to 5 minutes. We don't even have to, once we've taught a few units, then they have kind of super users that can train others pretty quickly, just right on the ground. So that's been great. And then we also have, a deeper integration in Epic where we have a specific window that's a sort of a tab in Epic where individuals can edit the summary and do other things with it, pull it into their progress notes, so on and so forth.
I'm so impressed by, not only do you speak the language of the big picture of the healthcare system executives, but you're even getting down to the details. You know the master file of columns. You just said PAF. I'm very impressed.
I was just thinking for your audience to be like, "What? What is that?" But I know you're an expert, so we're really into the details. We're very fortunate to have a twice monthly engineering meeting with Epic to kind of work on each of the details. And that's been fantastic. And so we've been kind of trying to make it as seamless as possible for the user.
So we talked a lot about the generative AI piece, the note summarization. Let's go back to those predictive models. I know they're not as hot of a topic right now, and they've been around for a long time, but they are still so important, and there's still so much value to be had there.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you, Taryn, because I think I read about your background that you've done predictive models, correct? Or you've worked on them?
Yes, I have worked on predictive models in Epic, and you are right. There are lots of predictive models, and people
Yeah.
say, oh, general risk score. Yes, I know this patient is high risk. I mean, I'm looking at them.
Exactly.
But you were even mentioning something like a predictive model for helping reduce length of stay. And I know that's always a huge priority for health systems.
Yeah, so my view on predictive models is that for many different areas, there's multiple ways to come up with a predictive model that has a fairly high predictive capability, however you want to measure it, C statistic or other approach. There's a lot of different approaches to it. We've really come to focus on what's the intent of the model, how much does it really help the user beyond what they don't already know. And how does it obviously fit into the workflow? And how do you make sure it's explainable and transparent? Like if you don't have all four of those things, then it's going to be more noise. Most clinicians and others are already totally inundated with so much information, not just what they might see in the record, but also just everything in their environment. And so I think most predictive models are not thought through well enough. They're not designed in an artisan-like way to really support the clinicians. And then if they're not, then they end up becoming a lot of noise and additional data that just really makes people jaded, actually. And they're just like, not another predictive model. I had an ENT surgeon who told me, I'd rather be, I think they used the word electrocuted through my teeth than see another predictive model. So, I mean, to give you an idea, that was a really interesting, colorful way of phrasing it. But where we've tried to focus is how do you not only do a model, but also hopefully, suggest a course of action or really make a set of options available that they can then use, and that you're also trying to, surface things that they may not know about or and that could actually be really useful. So we've done almost like 120 to 125 different predictive models in different clinical and operational areas. Some are much more useful than others, and we've really kind of learned our way on this. But to take your example of length of stay, an example of kind of what I would call a generation three or generation four predictive model is our ability to try to predict the when a patient's going to go home. Because if you can accurately predict who's going to go home today, with extremely high degree of accuracy, can you get up to a 91 to 95% accuracy? That could make a profound difference at the health system on multiple levels. The first is that if you have a case manager that has 20 patients and they're all sick or they all have various challenges or there's a lot of information to review, if you can really tell them who could go home today and these are the barriers that they might have to go home, then you're really prioritizing the individuals that, oh, I really need to focus on these because if I get these people home, I'm definitely going to be able to help reduce the excess length of stay. If I have a candidate that can go home and they should be able to go home and they don't go home, that's your first lowest hanging fruit, in terms of how you're affecting your length of stay. And then of course, then you have your predictions all across from who's going to take 2 weeks or 3 weeks to go home. And so one of the things that we've focused on is trying to use all of the information that we use to create a summary to also predict who might be able to go home. So we're looking at all the doctor's notes, nursing notes, all the consulting notes, then of course, looking at the physiology of the patient, the medications, the orders. When we look at the actual notes, we're deconstructing any kind of information that would suggest there's going to be some slowdown or some acceleration in their ability to get discharged. And the next generation component of this that we've been doing is using generative AI and combining it inside as features into the predictive model. So one example is if I, as a physician, said, I'm going to order an echocardiogram on this patient, if the echo is normal and the ejection fraction is normal, they can go home today. But if it's depressed, if the EF is like less than 20%, I need cards to come see the patient tomorrow, and they need to clear or decide what the plan is. And so at that moment in time, you might have a certain prediction, but then you could have the AI go and say, oh, this person is ordering an echo. Let me go find the echo result when it's done. What was the ejection fraction? Oh, the ejection fraction is 20%. Okay, I'm going to readjust the predictive discharge from today to tomorrow. So you're embedding inside the predictive model multiple if-then capabilities. And that if-then programming came from the doctor's note. So in our view, the doctor's note has now become the program.
Wow. So it's not, there's no worry about black box logic because you are clearly iterating. It's almost, yeah, it's almost like the provider is creating the logic for his patient. Yeah,
exactly. And that's why I love the SOAP note. It all comes back to now the documentation becomes a profound vehicle to the care delivery because you're essentially telling the AI, this is what I want you to look for. And when we've used these approaches, our model performance obviously goes much higher. And there's so much more to explore here. And there's so much more that our teams are doing. But it's basically the ability that the doctor is now the coder, in a sense.
Wow. I love that the models are not just informative. It's not just a number on a page like, yes, this is nice to know, but they're truly actionable. You can interact with the output and the input of the model.
Yeah, that's and that's where I think, you know, I really liked your point that they've been around for a long time. And there's, you know, people now, generative AI has gotten all the attention. But I think we're about to move into a completely different approach to predictive models that's going to really energize and impact care in a way that people haven't even really seen yet. I think we're just in the first inning of this. But it's the combination of predictive models plus generative AI.
It sounds like what you're describing is quite a bit of computing power. So is this only available for clients on the cloud?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, for our system is on the cloud, you know, and we're able to do a lot more with that. So you do need the computing power of the cloud to do it. Now, you know, everything is getting miniaturized over time. I don't know if there'll be a point where the computing power for these specific capabilities will drop. But right now you need fairly substantial computing power to do it.
What are some of the key metrics that you guys monitor to determine the impact on care?
So I think we're obviously, like a lot of generative AI companies, extremely interested in real-time savings for providers. I think the only way to really do it is to do time motion studies where you're literally documenting, you know, how the provider's kind of workflow is changing and watching them, you know, before and after and the multiple different approaches to do it, but essentially kind of time motion studies. There's also analysis just to look at how much time they're spending in the chart or in various parts of the chart. I think that's a cruder measure. It's harder to tell. You really need to measure like their global time and really watch them. But time savings is really important. We've been able to demonstrate, you know, on a per patient basis, you know, minutes saved, like 6 to 9 minutes per patient per shift, let's say for a physician or nurse. Then you add that up for all the patients that they might have on a shift. It obviously varies depending on the complexity of the patient, but you could get some, you know, serious time savings there. The second is the specific initiatives that we're working with the health system on. So if it's length of stay, are we seeing, you know, a reduction in the excess length of stay month on month? You can slice and dice that over a lot of different units or disease conditions. And then finally, of course, clinical outcomes themselves. Are you able to reduce the number of out of ICU cardiac pulmonary events? Are you able to reduce the number of readmissions? Are you able to reduce the number of kind of avoidable hospitalizations? So those are obviously the key clinical outcomes. And then more recently, we have been working in, as we moved into kind of progress notes and documentation, are we able to improve charge capture and revenue generation because you're getting kind of more complete and better notes? So those are kind of the areas that in metrics that we've been following.
And do you guys work with a specific client on their specific needs to develop a predictive model for them? Or do you have kind of a set list of here are our models, which one of these do you want?
Yeah, it's both actually. So we have a set of models that we're very confident in and have worked on with a number of different clients, but we also build the predictive models de novo if that's what they would like to do. We also are agnostic about predictive models. For example, if they want us to incorporate an Epic predictive model that they've built or that their own data science teams have built, we can incorporate that and use it in place of our predictive models or bring it into the summaries that we create. So our general view is that there's going to be a lot of different predictive models. They have different capabilities. If a health system has already designed a predictive model on their population and fitted it for that population, then that might be the better model to do, and we can monitor its performance over time. So we kind of take a agnostic view on the predictive models. We're seeing less and less of these third or fourth generation models where you have kind of embedded generative AI. That's more of our kind of specific strength that we can bring to the table.
So you mentioned earlier that you are big into analytics and clinical informatics. How do you think all of this AI is impacting the underlying data? Because I also am into,
Yeah.
building reports and kind of digging into that workflow data, and I can tell you exactly when the workflow broke down based on the data that's output.
In the literature right now, there's a lot of concern of all this synthetically generated text or generative AI information is going to degrade the EHR, or are you talking about something else?
It is kind of a loaded question, to be honest, is it's really easy to create free text, but from a data mining perspective, when you're trying to identify trends and patterns, it's hard to do that when you have so much free text. If we're loading all of this information in free text, are we kind of shooting ourselves in the foot and making it harder to identify those patterns and trends in data in the long run? And to your point, are we creating sort of an echo chamber where you load all the data once, and then you're just picking from the exact same data set over and over, and there's no net new information in the system?
Yeah, so those are two really important questions. I think on the first part, the importance of structured data, just verifiable objective structured data, is absolutely paramount. Like we still need to obviously maintain all the structured data components that are naturally structured data, for example, labs and physiologic data, vital signs, so on and so forth, medications. Then there's the structured data that we ask users to input through flow sheets and templates. I think all of those save a lot of time and are very valuable. What I think the unstructured data does is that it brings a level of nuance to the situation that is hard to capture in structured data. So I think that there's obviously a critical role for that information. I think our situation's improved with generative AI. You can use these generative AI tools to slice these structured data elements with all the nuance they bring into structured data that can then be used as features to look at trends and to look at and to be features that go into these predictive models. So I think our ability to kind of now harness unstructured data has improved with these tools, which can then be used for trending and other things like that. You'd have to have a fairly sophisticated knowledge of how to do those transformations properly from structured data to trendable, data that can be trended, because there's a lot of nuance in that. But if you can do that properly, I think it actually creates just for a richer set of analyses. I think your other point, or the other point we were discussing, which is the more and more generative AI content that emerges will create an echo chamber. I think that's absolutely true. Like that is a huge area of vigilance that both health system and companies like Pieces like ourselves need to be really paying attention to. And you can see it already on the internet, just how much detritus has been created, I think, from all the kind of sheer output. I think the ways that we're thinking about managing this is you clearly need the new input. Now, in healthcare, that new input is somewhat forced, meaning if a patient comes in for a visit, they're coming in with new information that the physician or nurse or someone has to listen to and bring into the record in some form, right? And maybe devices can help do that, but that would be new data. And that's true on the inpatient side, that's on the ambulatory side. So there's some protective mechanisms in healthcare that may not be present, let's say, on the internet or wide web, World Wide Web, where I think you're starting to get a huge proliferation of the synthetic content, which is going to degrade all the subsequent generative AI content. I think in healthcare, there's a force function that helps a little bit. And the second thing is, I think you can force re-anchoring on true and new objective data. So one thing that, for example, PIECES does is it will write a progress note for a physician, but it will not write a progress note unless there's been one good note written by that physician. And it uses that good note to anchor. It understands what the style of this physician, what matters to them. And it uses that note to then kind of generate the subsequent notes. And then at a certain point, it will request a new note or something like that. So I think there's different approaches that we could see if you move from one service line to another requires new input. So I think there's ways to put protections around the system, and there's also the force function that's natural to medicine. But no question, this is a really area important of vigilance and could easily degrade if people are not paying attention.
I love how you said there has to be one good note. That's tough to define. How do you define a note as good or not? But it's also great because it's preventing the atrophy of the skill of writing a good note. Because another concern, again, is if we automate everything, are we losing the skill to do it manually ourselves? But there is still a very large human component, and you are still practicing writing those notes. Like you said, there has to be the first good note, and I'm doing air quotes over here.
The good note, for us, you properly have stated, like, how do you determine that? And that's something that we've been working a lot on. But it's kind of like when you're, a middle school student or high school student in English class, and they're like, the teacher's like, okay, I have a rubric to evaluate your essay. That rubric has like these components, right? So we're trying to teach pieces to say, here's kind of a rubric for it, and these rubrics exist across. There's different ones for surgery versus internal medicine versus pediatrics. You need those health systems governance to be involved with that. And it's going to be an interesting journey to see kind of how some of these things play out. I think your other point, though, about how do you maintain human performance when automated performance continues to go become higher and higher? And I think this is a significant area of research and work for the entire AI community, because I think it's every endeavor as we see machines' performance increase, and yet we know that humans need to be supervising. How will they have that capability to supervise properly if they're doing it less and less? And if the machine is doing an excellent job 99.99% of the time, so that 0.01% of the time, will the human be ready for that moment, right? And I think that's a really challenging problem. I think one of the hard parts will be, if you're in an environment where the machine's performing at top performance 99.99% of the time, you're going to want to be in that environment because there's going to be a lot less error. There's going to be, better performance. I think the systems that get really distinguished, I'm talking about the human technical systems, which I would call health systems, are the ones that are able to perform that 0.01%. And that one, that I think is going to require a lot, including, I think some of the leading approaches are simulation and adversarial testing of the humans, and this continued requirements that we're going to have people need to do certain things from which the machine learns from. So I think this is going to be an area of profound research and dynamism, but is one of the critical problems that we have to address as AI gets better.
I love that you brought up the idea of adversarial testing and simulation. Healthcare organizations that I've worked with, they set up a phishing scam where they send all their employees an email and see who clicks on the link as part of a cybersecurity practice, right? And I think we have to use a parallel process when it comes to AI. Like, can we strategically make it output something wrong every couple of times so we can kind of gauge how much attention is the human paying? But the stakes are a little bit higher. obviously,
Yeah,
because if
exactly.
we do get away with a mistake in the chart, someone has to be on that like hawk eyes immediately so nothing bad happens to that patient. So it's walking a fine line and testing
Yeah.
how close attention the human is paying, but also keeping the patient safe.
Exactly. And I don't think I think that the concept that you're raising, which is sort of the adversarial injection of new input, probably can't happen. Obviously, in my view, it can't happen in a real record. But I think but that is one of the key ways. And I think that combined with simulation, I think is going to be very valuable. And I think our ability to simulate scenarios is also improving dramatically. If you think about it, we have, we conduct so much of our healthcare transactions on screens. So you could replicate those screens and really create it as lifelike a situation as possible, and then have people interact with it, and then have sort of this adversarial kind of testing. Yes, I agree with you. I think this is that is kind of the approach that some of the leading approaches to try to tackle the problem.
You seem to be some sort of visionary, so I'm going to ask, what do you foresee in the next 5 years of healthcare? How else will we integrate AI?
Well, I want to first say, like, there's been a lot of predictions I made that have not come to pass. So yeah, I have an interesting track record. I'm excited for where medicine is going. I know that there's a lot of hesitation and concern. I take a totally different approach. I think when college students or high school students or people that are thinking about being pre-med ask me, should I go into medicine? I say, absolutely. I think we're about to enter into a golden age where we're going to have some of the benefits that were there in the past, where you had a lot less burdensome documentation requirements. Still have documentation and take different forms, but it'll be so much within your flow that you'll have these sort of virtual assistants and machines that are working with you, and you're just really operating at the top of your license. And so much of the drudgery that has come into medicine and fear, with all the concerns, is going to be removed, because you're going to have these virtual assistants that are covering your back and surrounding you and providing a lot of support all the time. And I think people are going to feel really fulfilled practicing medicine. A lot of the stuff that the administrative layer that we've put on doctors and nurses and other things are going to get smaller and smaller, in my view, and then handled more and more by machines. And you can really focus on why we went into medicine, which is take care of people, heal them, spend time with them. And I think people are going to be, it's going to be like a golden era. I think it's also going to make healthcare accessible to many more people. I think many more people can go to medical school and become doctors, or all along the professional chain of healing. And then I think we're also going to see profound and positive impacts for patients, because AI is going to reduce the information asymmetry that currently exists and has existed. So when a person walks into a health system, there's an enormous imbalance of information, of knowledge, of how to get things done. And I think we're going to increasingly see virtual assistants that's working on behalf of the patient to help them understand what's happening, to help them make informed choices, to help them navigate these very complex systems. And so I'm really excited about that kind of future. And I think a lot of it, just to in terms of what the technology will be to support that, I think what we're going to see is all of these different individual components will start merging into these 360-degree assistants that will support the roles, whether it's the physician role or a subspecialist role or a nurse role or case management or a patient. And they're going to, they don't need to be overlords. I think they very much could be supportive agents. But they'll take away a lot of the stuff that's been very challenging and really allow people to spend a lot more time together and work on getting to the right answers. And then these systems will go work on it. So I'm incredibly excited by that. That's the kind of future that I think will come about. We'll have to have, obviously, incredible oversight and multiple kind of overlaying and redundant systems to make sure that these systems work accurately. And human in the loop, the whole concept of human in the loop will have to be with us for a long, long time. I don't see that changing, maybe forever, actually. But that's the kind of future I see with virtual assistants.
It's incredibly refreshing to hear such a positive outlook on the future of medicine, because everyone is just so burnt out. Everyone in the healthcare system is sick of the status quo. And could AI kind of be this solution to reduce some of that burden? And these are two major underlying benefits to pieces that you just slid in there as reducing that clinician burnout. You mentioned increased health literacy for the population as a whole, which is enormous.
Which is the best, right? That's ultimately where you want to go, where you have an extremely informed population. It gets back to like the shared decision-making at a totally different level.
Any last words of wisdom that you want to share about pieces or AI in healthcare in general?
The area of AI in medicine and in all forms of society needs to be a group effort, a shared effort. I don't think it's for, you know, certain companies to work on or certain individuals to work on or the government. I think everyone coming all the way down to the patient should get involved, because this is going to be, you know, the new substrate in which healthcare is delivered. And so I would encourage anyone that's listening that wants to work in this field from whatever perspective they have to join it, because I think we need as a diverse set of opinions, and I use diverse broadly, like every single conceivable position, looking at this and looking at it from their angle so that we can get to the best set of outcomes. So I really encourage more and more people to get involved.
This concludes today's Lean Health Tech podcast. If you're a listener and would like to hear a certain topic covered in future episodes, please let me know by leaving a review or comment. Thanks for joining, and be sure to check out the next episode.